Okay, welcome everyone. Again, my name is Molly Marin. You will see Dane's name appear. Dane and I are colleagues. We share the account with Adobe, but it is Molly Marin. I'll put my email address in the chat if anybody has any follow-up in terms of connecting with me in technology or certificates. It'll be in there for you. A copy of today's PowerPoint is available on our webpage. I'll also put that link in the chat for you, but it's nysrti.org. And keep in mind, all professional development opportunities can be found on our webpage. During today's webinar, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's webinar, we'll share a link to a very brief evaluation. Please take a few minutes to complete that. We appreciate the feedback. We do look at all of that information every week. And it is my pleasure to present the first webinar in a five-session webinar strand, Strand 23, Using Universal Design for Learning to Support Tier 1 Instruction. Today's topic is UDL, a Framework for Learning Design. We are excited to have with us today two UDL implementation specialists from CAST, Melissa Sanjay, I don't know if I'm saying that right, and Bill Wilmot. And at this time, it is my pleasure to welcome Melissa and Bill.
Thank you, Molly. Very excited to be here. I am on camera for the first half, and then I'm going to turn it over to Melissa after that. But welcome to the introduction to Universal Design for Learning. Like Molly said, this is the first of a series of webinars. We will get much deeper into UDL as we go. So we're just kind of laying groundwork today. If we go to the next slide, you'll see us and what Melissa and I look like. Please feel free to reach out. Our emails are there, and look forward to talking to anybody who's a part of the series. As Molly said, we're eager to get feedback as well on how things are going. Melissa, do you want to say anything just as a way of hello?
Sure. Hello. Welcome. My name is Melissa Sanjay, and Molly, you did pronounce it correctly, so thank you. I'm going to reiterate, because I think Bill already said it, but we want to be active in the chat and just kind of have a conversation as we go along. So I will be speaking without my face in the beginning, and you'll see me in the second half.
Excellent. And while I'm on camera, Melissa is monitoring the chat for me and vice versa. So we're all over that chat, so use it. All right. So Universal Design for Learning is all about options. So one of the big things that we encourage is find, especially at 4:15 in the afternoon, find whatever way you need to regulate your learning. Stand up, walk around, sit down, lie down. If you lie down too much, you might fall asleep, so just keep that in mind. Grab a fidget if you need that, and then think about how you want to reflect on your learning as we go. Options for taking in the information, you can follow the webinar. There's also here on the screen now a bit.ly. If you want to follow the PowerPoint at your own pace, you can get to it at that bit.ly right there, /bit.ly/BuffaloUDLintro. The bit.ly is case sensitive, so make sure you get everything in the right case there. We'll put that in the chat as well so people can get back to it. Options for participation, like we said, speak up in the chat, raise your hand. There's a raise your hand feature at the top of the screen. If you are interested in tweeting, feel free to tweet. We use the hashtags CASTPL, which is CAST Professional Learning, and the hashtag UDLChat, which is a very active national chat if you want to follow other UDL conversations. So the goal of Universal Design for Learning, and we'll dig much more deeply into this, the goal is expert learners, in developing expert learners. And we define expert learners as purposeful and motivated, resourceful and knowledgeable, strategic and goal-directed. So we are here today, 4:15 in the afternoon on a Monday, as expert learners. Everybody is an expert learner in some way at some time in their own context. And what's wonderful about any teaching and learning experience, you walk into a classroom, you walk into a webinar, If you have eight participants, you have eight different learners. If you have 20, you have 20 different learners. So I want you to, each person to think about themselves as an expert learner. What does it look like when you are purposeful and motivated, resourceful and knowledgeable, strategic and goal-directed? What kinds of behaviors do you have? What are you doing? What are you thinking about? What do you look like as an expert learner? So you can share that in the chat. You can take your own notes on the side if you want to, if you don't want to share it publicly. So think for a little bit about what it looks like when you are an expert learner.
All right, it looks like we have some folks responding. I'm seeing some themes about motivation. When we feel motivated, we work more quickly. Some people are excited to learn when they're motivated. There's also themes around materials, how people organize materials, or how people are able to access their resources and their materials.
I love the thinking about connecting back to your prior knowledge, because everybody walks into a classroom knowing lots of things. And sometimes we kind of assume that they're starting from nothing. But in reality, they have so much background, both in terms of how they learn, but what they know. And bringing that and figuring out how to connect that to what they're learning now is incredibly valuable. Jonathan, I'd love to hear more about what it looks like when you're excited to learn. Like, what do you do?
Jonathan says he wants to ask questions to find out more.
Yeah, excellent. All right, so we all look different as expert learners. Universal Design for Learning is really built on that idea of learner variability. So we're going to go through some core concepts of Universal Design for Learning, and we're going to approach it from a number of different angles. The idea, we're going to start with architecture and design. The idea of universal design originated with this guy. This is Ron Mace. Ron was born in the 50s, contracted polio, and was in a wheelchair and had a breathing device from a very young age. When he was diagnosed, his parents were told, well, the best thing for Ron really would be for him to be institutionalized. His parents disagreed, so they decided to keep him in school. He went to high school, the high school that he went to. This was before the Americans with Disabilities Act. The high school that he went to was not accessible. His parents had to carry him up and down the stairs to class in high school. This is a quote from his high school yearbook. It's the set of the soul that determines the goal. He was determined to get an education. He applied to and went to college. The college that he went to didn't have accessible dorms. So his mom rented a trailer, and they lived together in the trailer throughout college. And even through college, she carried him up and down stairs to go to class. When he graduated from college, he applied to be an architect, to an architecture school in North Carolina. The dean of the architecture school said, you shouldn't even bother trying. He made it through architecture school, and he became an architect, and he coined the term universal design. The idea of universal design is that you design buildings from the beginning to be accessible to everyone. The idea moved from architecture to lots of other fields of design. This is, we've seen old school buildings like this. The picture on the left is the front of the school. It's been retrofitted by adding this ramp on the right around the back. And there's a sign next to the front door saying disabled persons entrance at rear of the building, in a place where you can't even read it from the sidewalk. So something, a building that's universally designed would might look something more like this, where there's a ramp integrated into the design of the building. The design environment is created for the broadest possible group of users. Like I said, this idea has moved from architecture into lots of other areas of design. These are a few examples of universal design that has that have come up since then. The automatic doors that we all use when we're going in and out of the grocery store, in and out of the airport, curb cuts, which are essential. The easy grip tools, I think I am old enough, and probably Melissa, you're old enough to remember those old peelers that would cut into your hand when you were trying to peel a carrot. We've come a long way since then. Those easy grip tools were designed originally for people who had grip issues with arthritis or Parkinson's, those kinds of issues. And finally, closed captioning. The motto almost that's come out of the universal design world is that these innovations are necessary for some, but they're good for all. So let's pause for a second and think about share in the chat some times that you've used some of these technologies, some of these on the screen or maybe others that you could think of, and sometimes that they've been absolutely essential to you living your life, even if you're not in a wheelchair, even if you don't have mobility issues, even if you are not hard of hearing. So take an example and take a moment and think of some examples to share out. Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan is not only is he using easy grip tools, he's also a good husband. I like to watch British comedy, and I was watching a show that I had seen many times before, and I had the closed captioning turned on, and I was suddenly understanding things that I had never understood before in the show.
I was going to say that as well. I always turn on the captions when it's an accent.
Yeah.
I don't understand. And it looks also like a lot of people, myself included, and Bill and Jacqueline, like the curb cuts and the open doors when we're pushing or dragging lots of things around.
I always ask, who else might use a ramp when we look at the ramp photo? I have two boys, and both of them, when they were in the 3- and 4-year-old range, could not help but use the ramp. They had to have a ramp. ran up and down the road. Yes. So when the kids are being loud and you're trying to watch TV, you need the closed captioning. So we're going to watch a short video from the founder of CAST, David Rose. CAST has been around since the 80s, and actually Universal Design for Learning is a more recent innovation that came out of CAST. And David Rose is going to kind of talk through that shift in thinking that Universal Design for Learning really embodies. So when you get there, Molly, we're ready to watch.
At first, we felt the role that we should be playing was to use the great power of digital media to in some way fix the child, change the way that they were so that they could learn within the regular curriculum. But the more we did that in classrooms, the more we saw that there was another way to look at the problem, and that was that the original curriculum was poorly designed. We saw the kids as highly diverse, the curriculum as fixed and the same for everybody. So our children with physical disabilities couldn't hold the book and turn its pages. And the children who are blind couldn't see the book at all. The children who are dyslexic couldn't get the information out of it because they couldn't decode the words. Our first impulse was to try to fix the kids. But the kids were the way they are. And their diversity was part of what the classroom was. And we realized that we needed to change the books themselves.
So this idea, I think, is so important. As educators, we're so focused on the students and putting the students at the center, and we have all the right reasons for doing that. It's really a profound commitment to making sure that learning is working for each student. But in some ways, in order to do that and take account of the great variability that we have in our classrooms, we need to shift our focus from just focusing on the students to focusing on the barriers that they confront in the curriculum and in the learning environment. So this really embodies the first idea that we want to share, that the barrier is in the environment, not the learner. We talk a lot about learner variability and the great span of different learners that we have in our classrooms, but in order for those learners to be able to access the curriculum, we have to minimize all of the barriers that they're going to confront in the learning environment and in the curriculum. We use kind of the word curriculum to mean lots of different things. We use it to mean the learning environment, the actual learning materials, the learning goals, the assessment, and the instructional methods. So really every aspect of what you might call the learning environment or the curriculum. So let's go into our next, so there's the big takeaway from part one, the barriers in the environment. Let's go to our next session, looking at this from the neuroscience perspective. So this is kind of an old view of the brain, that there are specific parts of the brain that are responsible for specific aspects of our cognition and our thinking. Now, and that there are normal brains and there are abnormal brains. What we know is that there's a whole range of what might be considered normal, and that single areas of the brain are responsible for certain things, but really they're networked with all other areas of the brain. So it's not useful to think about it that way, but it's much more useful to think about it in terms of the various networks of the brain that are responsible for learning. So it's not just one particular location, but it's the many different sections of the brain or networks of the brain. So we really the process of developing the Universal Design for Learning guidelines was a process of looking at neuroscience research, cognitive psychology research, and cognitive neuroscience, and thinking about what is required to learn. And so we zeroed in on these three networks: the affective network, the feeling network responsible for emotion, responsible for a lot of the motor uh, and uh, and parasympathetic nervous system that accompanies emotion. The recognition network, that is how you take in information, either by seeing, hearing, touching, feeling. And the strategic networks, how do you manage all of that information? What do you do with it? So we think of those as the why network, that is the affective network. Why am I doing this? Why is this relevant to me? Why is this of value? The recognition network, the what am I seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, touching? And the how. How do I take all of that information in and organize it? So we're going to click out to watch another quick video here from, you'll hear from Kurt Fischer, who's one of the pioneers really in thinking about mind, brain, and education, and how do you integrate the latest neuroscience research into educational practice. So after we watch the video, let's take a moment, or even as you're watching, feel free to share reflections from the video or ask questions or make comments. All right, go for it.
Doesn't seem to give a second here. I'm thinking it's their site.
Sorry about this.
This may not go.
Okay. I'm going to put the link in the chat. It's there for folks to watch it.
Okay. I'm going to go back. I'm sorry.
Let's. Why don't we keep going, and if we can figure that out, then we will. Sorry about that technical glitch. But the video's in the chat, so if you want to go out and watch it some other time when you have a moment, I highly recommend it. Kurt is a incredibly knowledgeable and amusing guy. So what that led to, the research on those three networks really led to developing three principles that guide the UDL guidelines. So those are principles around engagement, representation, and action and expression. So the ideal is really to provide multiple means of engagement. And so that's thinking about how the affective networks, what they do. They monitor the internal and external environment to set priorities, motivate, and engage learning and behavior. The second principle is to provide multiple means of representation. That is how information is represented to learners. And one way to kind of check your understanding on this would be to say, what if I had a student who couldn't see? Or what if I had a student who couldn't hear? Am I providing information in a way that would be accessible to that person? And we know that in reality, even if we don't have a student who has a sensory disability like that, there are students for whom the way that information is represented can be really important and can be really alienating if it's not represented in an accessible way. And finally, is to provide multiple means of action and expression. That is how they're able to act on or express their learning. How do we know what they know? So that's really requires them to be able to organize their thinking and to strategize. So this is a picture of what's called a connectome. It's a representation of the interconnectivity of the brain. And as you can see, it's so much more complicated than this part is in charge of language, and this part is in charge of my right hand. Variability is the norm. The hard and fast black and white line that we've created, largely for legal reasons, between somebody having a disability and someone not having a disability, is, from a neuroscience perspective, really an artificial construct. Really, there's a vast continuum of variability of learners in all kinds of dimensions. And those three networks are really the three key dimensions which contribute to learning that we need to think about. So variability is the norm. That's the big takeaway from our neuroscience section. Next, we're going to dig into the Universal Design for Learning guidelines. Oops. Okay. So I started on this already, but it really comes down to these three questions. How will students engage? How will they perceive information? And how will students act on their understanding? So let's just do some brainstorming in the chat right now, or you can write in your own notes. What kinds of variability have you seen in each of those areas, in how students engage, in how they perceive information, and how they act on their understanding? So do some sharing in the chat when you have ideas around that.
So Jonathan says he has some students that like to plan things out and others who want to skip steps to get to the final product. I have had that conversation myself in years in alternative schools where students just want to skip to the end and because they already know the steps. There's some things about engagement Bill put in there.
One of the I taught math and science, but one of the Russell's always when teaching math are those students who can do it all in their head and don't need to show their work, and they get the right answer. And then you know at some point they're going to need to be able to show their work in order to get the right answer consistently. But, you know, how and when do you push back on that and have that conversation? And they will shut down if you force them to do it.
I've also had students who can explain concepts but cannot write the concept.
Yeah. All right, so Molly has the video ready for us now. Tracy says, my students like to use graphic organizers to help aid them in challenging math concepts. These graphic organizers seem to empower them. Yeah, so that is a great option to. We always think about in UDL, something that helps one person could be useful for lots of people, and we may not know that. So providing something like that graphic organizer, making that an option for everybody, can be a really powerful way to make it okay to use that, rather than it being something that you don't want to use, or maybe you're trying to move beyond. But when it's the right thing, when it's not interfering with your learning goal, really to make that available to everyone. So I think we're going to watch the neuroscience video, and then so feel free to jump in with questions and comments as we're going through the video.
A couple of hundred years ago, people created what we call phrenology now, where they thought about specific places in the brain as having to do with a specific psychological characteristic or cognitive characteristic. And a lot of people still talk like that. But with the new imaging tools, such as MEG or magnetoencephalography, which is the magnetic waves that the brain gives off naturally, we can look at those waves in order to see what the brain is doing and which areas of the brain are connected to each other as somebody does something or perceives something. So the word dog flashes on the screen. What should happen in the brain according to the traditional analysis? The first thing would be that the back of the brain would light up, and then the language areas of the brain would light up. What actually happens is exquisite. It's so much more complicated than that. We see the back of the brain light up first, and then the whole brain gets involved in a rich symphony of activity. It actually moves back and forth. It's not just one-directional. So we've just been talking about a person seeing one word, like dog. Most of the time, we're talking to each other, we're reading, we're listening to each other, and so we're involving many, many words put together in meaningful sentences, in meaningful paragraphs, in jokes, in comments.
What are some things that we know about how to work through this problem?
In a classroom, teachers understand intuitively, many of them, the complexity of learning and the huge differences across children in how they learn. This gives us a beginning sense of how the brain reflects much of that complexity.
I like that idea that he ends with, that there's this incredible complexity, right? Even for something as simple as hearing and interpreting the word dog. So take a minute or so to write down some questions or reflections after listening to that video, thinking about what does that mean for learning.
Jonathan said that he watched a TED Talk that said we can't ever really multitask. We just switch back and forth. I also saw something about that, Jonathan, and it comforted me, because I always, when I am cognitively engaged, I can't pay attention to anything else. So it comforted me to know there wasn't a skill that I was bad at.
Okay.
And Bill, you mentioned that, yeah, we only know a little bit, and I think that's probably true.
Yeah, and I think that, to me, that that is what is really incredibly valuable about the UDL guidelines. This is not the the end all. This is not the final conclusion about what neuroscience means for learning. This version of the guidelines that CAST published is probably, I don't know, version 5 or 6, and just came out in January. We're constantly revising it, and the goal is really to summarize what we know as of now about neuroscience and the implications for learning.
And the guidelines website is in the chat now.
Yeah, excellent. So thank you, Molly, for putting that in there. So I encourage you right now to go to the UDL guidelines. You can get a PDF version that looks like this slide, but the much more interesting version is this interactive version of the guidelines. That will take you through each of these checkpoints and give you really a lot of the research behind that and where that checkpoint came from. We're going to do much more on the guidelines later on in this series, so we're going to be digging into that. So we'll have lots more time to look at that. So this quote, I think, is just wonderful, kind of encapsulates a lot of things. All learning is the interaction between the learner and the environment. And we have no power to change the learner. Our power is really to change the environment and change the learning environment. And we do that in a UDL context by providing options for how people engage with their learning. So here are just a couple of ideas of what we mean by that. So how will students engage? They might have a choice of two relevant texts. So if your goal is to understand how students decode, you might allow them to choose a text that's meaningful for them. Because in that case, the actual text that they're reading might not matter as much. If you're looking at representation and how information is represented to them, you might look here in the representation slides as guideline and think about how students will perceive. Well, you could read aloud to them. You could give them individual paper or digital copies. You could have a voice recorded version of the text. Melissa is going to talk a little bit more in a minute about goals and being clear about what our goals are. If your goal is to understand how well they decode, then a read aloud is not going to help you accomplish that goal. So you have to be clear about what your goal is from the beginning. Now over here is in the action and expression guideline, how students will act on their understanding. You could provide them options for how they express what they know, a podcast, an infographic, a thesis paper, a blog, a graphic organizer. Thank you, Tracy. So it all depends on what your goal is. Okay, I have to turn off this arrow. Oh, there we go. The goal of all of Universal Design for Learning is expert learning. So I'm going to turn it over to Melissa now, and she is going to take us through the end of our webinar today.
Hello. We have one comment in the chat. Jonathan had students writing reflections today. Students not motivated to do so, have them record their reflections through Adobe Sync. So that's a great option for sure for students. So we're going to talk a little bit now, given that we've been talking about the core concepts or key understandings for UDL being the barriers in the environment of the learner, variability is the norm, and the goal is expert learning. We came up with this design process in order to use the guidelines in a strategic way, in order to choose the options that make the most sense when they use it. We sort of try to wield these guidelines as a surgeon might wield their scalpel to be very precise about when we're doing things. So the UDL design process is setting clear and rigorous goals, anticipating barriers, to the achievement of those goals and designing options for students to minimize those barriers. So what we're going to go over today is the setting clear and rigorous goals, and we'll have time in some of our other sessions to really dig into those other two. So universally designed goals. Much like you have to tell your GPS where it's going, our brains are goal-directed. So we've heard a lot about neuroscience, and that's another piece of neuroscience, that our brains are goal-directed, and they want to... it's not a step-by-step process to get to an end, but our brains often think of the final first and then design backwards in order to get there. So when we're setting our goals, we want to make sure that the goals are flexible. And what we mean by that is that the means are not embedded in the goal. So as in Bill's example, when your goal is decoding, you wouldn't necessarily have to say that you have to read Charlotte's Web in order to decode. You could read something that's interesting to you. So the means itself doesn't have to be, shouldn't be embedded in the goal. We want to make sure the goals are clear and discrete. We don't want any compound goals, goals that are two goals in one. And we want to make sure that they are rigorous goals. So when you're designing a UDL goal, you want to ask yourself, is my goal specific? And is the how embedded? And if so, does it need to be? Because sometimes the how does need to be embedded. And then what can I do to scaffold or support the learning for students? So I'm going to kind of walk us through a thought process for when you're doing a goal. So the goal we use a lot when we're talking about this is students will write a 5-paragraph essay on the life cycle of butterflies. So we ask ourselves, is that goal specific? Is that how embedded? And how can we scaffold it? So we think, the goal is specific, but it seems like there might be two things going on there. So a way that we could rewrite this goal is if I am interested in my students demonstrating an understanding of the life cycle of butterflies, maybe I don't need them to only express it in one way. Maybe they could write a 5-paragraph essay. Or maybe they could do something else. Maybe they could explain it to me. Maybe they could put together a graphic novel that shows at each stage of the life cycle of butterflies. So we could adjust this goal such that it says students will demonstrate an understanding of the life cycle of butterflies. That way the means are not embedded, and as I go through the lesson, I could design in those options for them to demonstrate their knowledge to me. Similarly, if I want my students to write, I want them to learn how to write a 5-paragraph essay, it does not have to be on the life cycle of butterflies. It could be on something that's interesting to them. They could write a 5-paragraph essay on the ninjas is one that our colleague Neil always uses, on the importance of ninjas in society. But they could write it on a topic of their choice, and then I am assessing whether or not they can write a 5-paragraph essay. Not the topic that they're writing. So often when we get this, when we do these goals, sometimes because the goals are discrete and simplified, sometimes folks think that that might mean that we are reducing the rigor. So we often get a rigor question. So what we want to remember is that measuring skills and knowledge at the same time does not necessarily equal rigor. Difficult does not necessarily equal rigor, and inaccessible really doesn't equal rigor. So we're not trying to kind of water things down. We're just trying to be discreet and do things in one at a time. And often I also get the question of, when do the kids have to write? Because we use the example where we take the 5-paragraph essay out. And the answer to that is when the goal is about writing, students have to write because that's what the goal is. So you're just taking up the means to get to the goal. So you want to know what your goal is. So we have some examples here for you to try. I'm actually going to put them all up at the same time and give you some time to write in the chat how you rewrite those goals so that they are specific and the means are not embedded. Jonathan said, students will demonstrate their understanding of the main idea in Because of Winn-Dixie, taking out that they would have to make a poster, which is great. I might even take it one step farther, Jonathan, and say students will demonstrate their understanding of the main idea in a text of their choice, or in a writing or a video of their choice. Bill says students will record observations about an egg and Coca-Cola, taking out right. I'm giving them other options to record their observations. Oh, your son just read Winn-Dixie for his class. That's great.
Jackie, that's great. Yeah, demonstrate their understanding. That phrase often makes its way into goals where we're being careful about the means, because the means could take on lots of different forms. One of the things that I love about this is that you can build a lot of those options into your classroom, so it can become a regular way of thinking about, well, what are the different ways that I could demonstrate my understanding? And students start to become then much more metacognitive and thoughtful about the directions that they choose to go to demonstrate their understanding.
Yeah, and they become more creative, and then and that moves us closer to the goal of them becoming expert learners. Oh, and Jackie added, in a way that they feel comfortable. Yeah, that's great.
To me, this is one of the really important parts about thinking about how students become an expert learner. It really, they're making the choices based on the options that we give them. But then as they're making those choices, they're actually building their skills at making those decisions, and they're getting better at those. So it's not just a totally hands-off process. We can actually coach them through that. Not by eliminating options, but by saying, oh, well, what option did you choose last time? How did that go? What would you do differently this time? So that's really where kind of the art of coaching as a teacher comes in to Universal Design for Learning.
Great. So I'm just going to spend a few seconds on the next two parts of the UDL design process. So the next section will be anticipating barriers, and I believe we have an entire session on that. I think that might be session 3, and then the next one is to design options to minimize barriers, and that will in part be in session 3, but we also have an entire session. Session 5 is all about the guidelines, so we'll walk through the guidelines, how they were designed, and how we can use them. So as we're going to do this one last activity, and then we are going to open up for questions, et cetera. But what we like to do when we first introduce the concepts of UDL is we like to sort of connect it to other things in the world so that we can deepen our understanding and explore wider applications of UDL. So we have three analogies that we normally go through. And the first is brought to us from, I believe, someone in Canada. And Molly's going to show that to you on the screen. It's an analogy of UDL and bowling. So we're ready whenever you are, Molly.
Hi, my name is Shelley Moore, and I'm a third-year PhD student at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. As Canadians, we have a reputation for finding and embracing the strength in our diversity. This value, however, hasn't been reflected in our classrooms, which still segregate students by ability, especially students with developmental disabilities. There's a gap in our understanding about what we know inclusive education to be, philosophically, versus what we understand and the importance of understanding inclusion in our practice. This is the question I'm trying to answer in my research, is how can we find the value in the day-to-day practice in our classrooms in terms of inclusive education? How am I going to explain this to you? Now, I could sit here and try and describe this, or we could have a little bit more fun. Why don't we go bowling? So let's talk about bowling. You have 10 pins, you have 2 balls, and you have a lane. The goal is to knock down as many pins as you can. But if you don't get them all, it's okay because you have another chance. But when I bowl and roll the ball down the middle and I don't knock them all down, what often ends up happening to me is that there's 2 pins left standing on either end and they stare at you. It's the 7-10 split and it's the hardest shot in bowling. How is bowling like teaching? The ball is the lesson, the pins are the kids. We aim for the middle, we do the best we can. The pins that are left standing, we often have another chance to kind of get to them, but at the end of the day, those 2 pins that are staring, looking at you, are our kids who need the most support and our kids who need the most challenge. So we end up choosing one, and the other one is left standing. I just took all the fun out of bowling. Now, I don't know how many times you've watched professional bowling, but I spent an afternoon watching professional bowling, and let me tell you, there was not one bowler who rolled that ball down the middle of the lane. They throw the ball down the lane at a curve. And I was actually really curious about this, so I called up a professional bowler. He was so excited. I don't think he gets a lot of calls about education. He said the reason why the ball has to enter at a curve is because you will knock down more pins and create a bigger domino effect if you enter at that angle. But in order to do that, you have to change your aim. In order to knock down the most pins with one shot, he aims for the pins that are the hardest to hit. Now let's just let this sink in for a second. We are taught to teach the head pins. We are not taught to teach to the kids who are the furthest and the hardest to get to, the kids with autism, the kids with Down syndrome. The part that's critical here, and it really aligns with Universal Design for Learning, is that so often the supports that we design for those kids on the outside of the lane are actually supports that all of the kids need. This is the part we need to understand if inclusive education is going to move forward in Canada. How can we find this value of diversity in our classrooms between the students? This is not just important for the outside kids, critical for every single one of us. And just think, all we need to do is change our aim. Look how bowling changed education.
Great. Thank you, Molly. So we wanted to pause here for a second for any thoughts or questions on this video or reflections. Jackie loves it. We do get a lot of positive feedback about this video in particular.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. All right, great. Lots of folks love it. I used to try to bowl. My parents were in a bowling league, and what I would do is I would throw it down the middle and turn too fast, and then it would just go into the gutter. It does make it clear, and sometimes I think about those 2 pins staring at you as those 2 kids staring back at you while everybody else is moving forward. All right, so well, the next way we like to think about UDL is the dinner party analogy. So I'm having a dinner party, and I have decided to make a Mexican lasagna. Now, Mexican lasagna is a little different from a regular lasagna, and that there's, you know, as you can see, there's beans and corn there, there's taco seasoning. Sometimes people use tortillas instead of lasagna noodles, and there's, of course, all the taco seasoning and then the Mexican cheese, all the different cheeses. And so then that's what I'm going to make for my dinner party. That is the only option. I've spent a lot of time. I love this recipe, and that is what I am making for my dinner party. But the question is, can everybody eat this? So we always ask, what type of people couldn't eat this Mexican lasagna? So think to yourself, you can put it in the chat, or you can just kind of note to yourself, who could not eat this Mexican lasagna or would not eat this Mexican lasagna? And I always like to say, I would not eat the Mexican lasagna because I had a bad experience when I was a child where my mother served me rabbit masquerading as chicken, and she told me it was chicken, and so now I cannot trust food that is not what it pretends to be. It pretends to be something it is not. So I only like food that is, like, honest and straightforward. So I have multiple attendees typing, who could not eat this Mexican lasagna? So gluten, vegan, yep. Okay. Bill has a lot of folks in his family that could eat this Mexican lasagna. His family is not coming to my dinner party. So, as many said, vegetarian, vegan, lactose intolerant, gluten-free. So instead of just making one dish for my dinner party, I might decide to choose a different kind of menu design. This is a make-your-own burrito bar where there's lots of options. You know, if you don't want onions, you don't choose the onions. If you don't want lettuce, you don't choose the lettuce. You can choose your level of spice. You can put those jalapenos on if you want, and you don't have to put those jalapenos on. Yet everybody still gets fed. So that is our second analogy for UDL. Yes, and Tracy says food allergies are very common, which is true. And it takes us back to the predictable variability idea that Bill went over, where there's lots of things that we can predict might not work for folks. And so we can predict that there is going to be folks that don't have, that have gluten intolerances or that cannot eat cheese. So. And that's why we do this proactive way of designing our lessons. And the last analogy we like to use is the GPS analogy. The GPS analogy, as I mentioned, in the goal setting around, you have to tell your GPS where it's going before you actually start it up. You can't say, take me somewhere, Siri. You know, you decide today. You have to put in your destination, and it's going to give you options as to how to go. And if you decide you're going to take a left, it'll adjust for you. And it'll say, okay, she doesn't want to take the highway, she wants to go that way, and it'll adjust for you. So, and you can also, there's selections in the GPS. You know, I don't want to do toll roads. I want to do the shortest route, not the fastest time. But you do have to put that goal in. Otherwise, none of the other networking pieces work. And so that is our the last way that we like to think about UDL. And as kind of a fun final step, we'd like to just ask for folks to put in the chat either the one analogy that they like the most, or if they'd like to come up with their own analogy, put that in the chat as well. Tracy likes the Mexican lasagna. Yeah. I like how it links back to the predictable variability, too.
One of the things that came up one time when I used the Mexican lasagna analogy was, well, don't you still have standards that you have to pursue? And, yeah, absolutely. And so you're in charge of making the deciding on what the options are. So if you decide that you're not going to offer onions as an option, then that's fine. You're not offering onions as an option. It gets back to being very clear about what your goal is. And if your goal is writing, then you're going to have to get them to do some writing. But even you know, even saying that your goal is writing is being too vague because perhaps your idea, perhaps your goal is around idea generation, which is a very different goal than organizing your thoughts. So getting down to even that level of what your goal is so that you can provide options that will support idea generation versus organizing your thoughts.
Yeah, the bowling analogy does open a new perspective. It also puts the students at the center, which I like about the the bowling. No pun intended, at the center. That's why I like the bowling analogy. So now what we have about 15 minutes left, and so we have time here for questions. or comments. Before we get into that, I just want to, and I apologize for I have not done a slide for this, just remind you about what's upcoming. So not next week, because we have a holiday, but the week after, we're going to do Learning Variability. That's Monday, November 19th, and you can also find this on the website. So we're going to talk about learner variability being the norm. And then after that, we'll talk about barriers in the curriculum and the teacher as the designer to eliminate those barriers. December 3rd will be the language of UDL, Shifting Mindsets. And then session 5 will be the guidelines, exploring the guidelines of UDL and the concepts and trying to do kind of a guidelines deep dive. So do folks have any questions, anybody want, or any comments they want to put in the chat?
Well, while we're waiting here, I'm going to post the link to the evaluation, and I do hope everybody will take a minute or two to complete that. We do appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing that I was going to say is it's going to advance people's learning a lot. I think if you try something out in between each of these sessions, we have a unique opportunity because we have 5 or so hours together and time in between each one. So I would encourage you to try out writing a goal and be very thoughtful of when you're writing that learning goal about separating the means from whatever your learning target is. And then think about offering different options for students to show what they know. So that's kind of working on the goal and working around that action and expression guideline. Mm-hmm. You can go right to that link that we shared for the UDL guideline. And that will give you some specific ideas for how you could offer options around having students share what they know, offering different options there. This is often a good place to start because it kind of you have to be very clear about what your goal is and then think about, well, what am I going to see as, what am I going to accept as evidence that students have met that goal or who have learned in that area. So it's a good way to start on thinking about how to offer different options. So questions, comments, or discussion?
You can also put in the chat something that you're going to try out.
Okay. It doesn't look like we have any questions.
It doesn't look like it. We've all gotten very quiet and tired. Hopefully you're not asleep on the other end. But thank you, everyone, for joining, and we're excited to see folks next time.
And Melissa and Bill, thank you so much. We look forward to the 19th. We hope everybody will join us again at 4:15 on Monday, November 19th. We look forward to it, and everybody have a good evening. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.